It's time right now for Radio Vermont's News and Public Affairs program, Open Mic, with Chester Fuller. Hester. You know, I can't tell you how many years I've been in radio.
I know
who you are, Hester.
I know you know who I am. And Mr. Mann, you will know after here.
Well, you see, they put it in brackets, and the bracket looked like a C.
It looks like a C. That's okay. It's not the first time I've been called that.
You're not getting any sound?
Take two.
There we go.
It's time for Radio Vermont's News and Public Affairs program, Open Mic with Hester Fuller. The phone lines to speak with Hester are open right now, and let me give you the actual numbers and not the fire department. 802-244-1777. And toll free 1-877-291-8255. And here's your host, Hester, with an H, Fuller.
Thank you, Joe, with an L.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, indeed, it is Open Mic, and I am your host, Hester Fuller, from now until 11 o'clock this morning. My guests this first hour are Bess O'Brien, who many of you may recognize her name as the producer of The Hungry Heart, a wonderful documentary film, well, wonderful, scary, powerful documentary film that came out, was it three years ago, about the problem of prescription drug abuse in the state of Vermont. Now, shortly thereafter, our governor switched his whole focus in the following State of the Union message, State of the State address, to really pour resources into this and really focus on that. And joining us is Gary Miller, who is the creative director of the project that we are going to be discussing this morning. It's called Writers for Recovery. And I will let you guys tell us, in a nutshell, what is this program?
Well, I'll start off and then I'll have Gary follow up with me. Writers for Recovery really did come out of my documentary film, The Hungry Heart. We shot a lot of the film in the St. Albans area. And after I finished shooting the film, which was in the spring of 2013, I wanted to do one more sort of thing in the community. I wanted to get some more voices. I'd met so many amazing people. Dr. Fred Holmes, who I'd been focusing the whole documentary on, was working with me on continuing to, get these stories out. And so I had this idea of doing a series of workshops over the summer with people in recovery around writing, photography, and other arts-related forms. And so we did it at the local Turning Point, the Recovery Center in St. Albans. And we really had no idea what was going to happen. We didn't know how many people were going to show up. We didn't know how they were going to relate to these writing prompts and this idea of writing and telling your story.
And specifically the group that you were inviting to participate here were folks in recovery, I guess.
They were folks in recovery from drug addiction and or alcohol addiction. And we were just so amazed because a lot of people came and a lot of people wrote and a lot of people just loved the workshops. And we were just so awed by their articulateness and just their voices were just so stunning.
And we're going to hear some of those voices in just a minute. Gary, I want to ask you, you have led some of these workshops, correct?
That's right.
Can you tell me a bit about the process that's involved? What happens if someone were to participate? What would they experience?
Sure. Well, first of all, workshops last about an hour and a half, and during that time, we usually do a number of writing prompts. By a writing prompt, I mean just a simple, maybe opening line for a piece that they might write, usually. Whoever's leading the workshop, in this case either Bess or myself, will give a prompt and then say, okay, you have 7 minutes, go. And that 7 minutes has proven to be incredibly powerful. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that when you're told you have 7 minutes and go, there's no time to think, I'm a terrible writer, there's no time to think, I can't do this. There's no time to think. I don't have anything to say. There's only time to write. Mm-hmm. And what happens in that 7 minutes is just completely miraculous.
I'd like to hear some of the things that evolve out of the writings that begin in these workshops. One key component of the program, I believe, is that it's not enough just to come and write. You need to share your story. And I guess that can take a couple of different forms, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of recovery from addiction and really anything is that you have to share your story. You have to start reflecting on what you've done, where you're going. And it's very cathartic. It's very cathartic. I mean, my documentaries, I hope, are a way of people sharing their stories. And by doing that, you release something. You know, you move forward. And so the people, I think, who are coming to these workshops, who are extremely diverse from very different backgrounds, very different, you know, age range, are coming because it's part of their recovery process. Some people, you know, are in AA, NA. They're in therapy, they go to groups, they do all kinds of things. This is just another part of their recovery process, is this writing.
I'm talking with Bess O'Brien and Gary Miller about the Writers for Recovery Project. It's a series of workshops for folks who are in recovery from drug or alcohol addiction. And we're talking about the process that they have folks do. And we're going to also talk a bit about what is produced. Now, in addition to getting up and telling their stories or reading their work, folks may end up between two covers. Is that correct?
Yeah,
that's correct.
Tell me about the volumes that have come out of the project.
Well, just a little while ago, when did we come out with this?
January.
In January, we came out with a book called One Imagined Word at a Time, and that collects the work of 40 people from across Vermont who participated in Writers for Recovery, one piece each from 40 different people. We published it ourselves, and it's fantastic.
Can we hear a little bit?
Yeah. Sure.
Can you preface it with a little bit of background, the story of the story, like where these came from?
Well, I'll start out. So usually, as Gary said, we usually give them a prompt. Mm-hmm. And this one I love. So we usually focus on, you know, when they were in the middle of their addiction and then sort of where they are now in their lives. And so this one is them talking about recovery. And I believe this is yours, right? You give them...
I gave them a prompt called A Recipe for Sobriety.
A Recipe for Sobriety, and they had to write in 7 minutes. So this is called Sobriety Stew, and it's by Curtis Thompson, who's from Barrie.
That's correct.
And I just love this one. Sobriety Stew. One tender and loving mom, one already seasoned old school stepfather, one heavenly-spirited big sister for inspiration, two 20-pound cats, extra cuddly and playful, three cups of therapy, one cup going back to school to become a teacher, two tablespoons writing and reading every day, two tablespoons music, a cosmic dance of the soul, two tablespoons laughter, season liberally with forgiveness, patience, understanding, and love, stir gently and often, allow to simmer one day at a time.
A recipe for sobriety stew coming out of the Writers for Recovery Workshop Project. That is the project of my two guests this morning. If you have questions or comments about this, or if you have a story to share yourself, please give us a call here at Open Mic. The phone numbers are 244-1777 or toll free 1-877-291-8255. As always, listeners make this show, so we'd really love to hear from you. If you've participated in a workshop, we'd especially like to hear from you. And if you're just sort of thinking that it might be a good idea for yourself or someone you know and you'd like to know more about it, give us a call, because if the question is in your mind, it's probably in somebody else's mind, and you'd be doing a public service by asking it here, where the two folks best equipped to answer that question are sitting here and waiting for your thoughts and comments. Gary, why do you think writing has such a powerfully therapeutic effect on people that are at this juncture in their lives?
You know, I've thought about this a lot. I think there are a lot of factors that play in. One is that there's some kind of difference, some kind of brain process or something that happens between your mind and the page.
Oh, you can't hear? Yeah. No, fix it. We got little issues
and,
here.
You know, there's just some kind of magic that happens there when you pick up a pencil and start to write, or a pen and start to write. It's a different way to process the information, and somehow you can reach a little deeper
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of these people... A lot of these people... sorry.
That's okay. We're having some technical adjustments here. We're trying to get this right. Is that okay? All right, there we go.
A lot of the people who come to these workshops are at different parts of their recovery. I mean, we have people who are, you know, 3 days into their recovery. We have people who have been in recovery for 25 years. And so they're coming for all different reasons. Some people come to the workshops because they used to love to write in their earlier years. Mm-hmm. And they haven't written for years and they want to get back to it. Some people, it's just something new. It's, you know, I think people, you know, are constantly working on their recovery in different ways. You know, there's no one way to recover. So some people love to go to AA meetings and that's their main focus. Other people, you know, want something more creative to do, to work out their issues and to move forward. So this is just another way to do it. But I do think that it doesn't put distance there, but it creates sort of another way of telling your story. You know, I think a lot of times in therapy and documentary films and, you know,
and other 12-step.
Other 12-step, you know, you're telling your story. You're just telling this is what happened to me. But in this particular Writers for Recovery, you're given a prompt to think about something a little bit different. Like one of the things we do is we do, you know, write for 7 minutes about a morning during the middle of your addiction. For 7 minutes. And so that means somebody has to go back to that time, you know, the worst time in their life, and think about getting up in the morning. And you know, I often say, I'm sure Gary does too, I often say, you know, what are the sounds you're hearing? What's the smell in the room? What are the colors you're seeing? What's the day like? What does your room look like? Things to sort of bring them back to that time and write about it in a creative way. So it's working with their addiction on a different level. Uh-huh. Which I think can really express something that maybe they haven't been able to before.
Now, are there any pieces in the volume that you produce that respond to this?
Yeah,
we
actually have a whole section called Addiction, in which people write about their addictions. But there is a great piece among many great pieces in the book that came directly from the prompt Bess just mentioned. It's called A Morning When I Was Using, and it's by Joshua Anderson. I would get up before she's awake, strong black coffee in the shower, cold and to the point to save time. Shaving too, avoiding eye contact as much as possible. Leave the shower, skin soft and veins popping. Reach for my heroin hobby kit in the brown leather shaving bag I stole from my father. Use needles, clean needles, cheap aluminum tins, Q-tips, and tiny wax envelopes with words like Black Magic, Reagan, and Ambition stamped on them. I begin the ritual, mix the shot, find the vein, draw back, push down, push off, push away. Heroin gives me a chance, I think, the strength to look myself in the eyes. I stare in the mirror and see a mask, and I adjust it, but no matter what I do each morning, my mask gets harder and harder and harder to breathe through.
Very powerful piece.
Yeah.
Very powerful.
It's very intense, and I think it gives, you know, so much a part of so much of being an addict is having to hide everything, mm-hmm. And to be dishonest. And I think once people emerge into recovery, there's two things that I've really noticed. One is that they're just heartbreakingly honest. They're sick of lying, and they really want to tell the truth. And the other is that I think on some level, they understand the value of telling the story, getting it off their chest. This is something they've wanted to say, they've needed to say, and it's really helpful for them.
And they're in a workshop setting, which means they're in a group of peers, basically.
And people are incredibly supportive. They're, you know, people clap, people, you know, give each other hugs. People say, you know, that must have been really hard for you. I do want to say, though, that if people are out there listening and they're thinking of maybe joining a Writers for Recovery workshop, which we would love, you know, you're not required to write anything to be a part of Writers for Recovery. I tell people you can just show up and sit and listen or maybe talk a little bit. And if you write something, you're not required to read it. or you're not required to share it on our blog, which we have an excellent blog with tons of student work at writersforrecovery.org. And you're not required to put it in a book. You know, we just want to see you there. I think by and large, people do, when they do show up, even if they're nervous a little bit in the beginning, they end up sharing and they end up having, you know, a really good experience. But we want to make it as comfortable for people as possible, so there's no pressure. And as I tell people all the time, there's only one rule. There's no way to do it wrong. It's not school. It's not grammar and punctuation. And it's not even about, you know, making you a better writer, although that will probably happen if you stick with us. But, you know, there's really no way to do it wrong.
I'm speaking with Gary Miller, who is the creative director of the Writers for Recovery Workshop Series, and Bess O'Brien, the producer of this series. We're talking about Writers for Recovery, a series of writing workshops that are focused on stories of addiction and recovery. How many of these workshops have you guys done so far?
Okay, well, we've been doing this really for about a year and a half full time, coming on to 2 years. And I think we've done about 10.
Yeah, probably getting close to 10. Yeah.
And we have just secured funding to do our 2016 series of workshops, which are going to be around 10 again. And I do have to thank some of our underwriters.
Well, you know what? We will do that in just a minute. We need to stop and do a little bit of business. The time has just been flying by here because this is a really interesting to me topic. And we will be back on Open Mic right after these words. Good morning and welcome back to Open Mic here on WDEV. Hester Fuller is my name, and my guests this morning are Bess O'Brien, the documentary filmmaker you may know from film The Hungry Heart that she released a couple of years ago about the problem of prescription drug abuse in the state of Vermont, and Gary Miller, who works with Bess on a wonderful project called Writers for Recovery. It's a series of writing workshops focused on stories of addiction and recovery. We would love to hear from you. We would love to have your questions and comments, too. Please think about picking up the phone. Give us a call, 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. Bess, right before the break, we were talking a bit about how the workshops are structured and supported. It seems, when I look at the back of the book, you've had quite a lengthy list of supporters, folks who are really getting behind this idea.
Yeah, well, I just would like to quickly thank them because without the support of our many underwriters, we could not do these workshops. So some of the people and organizations that have supported us are the Rona Jaffe Foundation, which is actually out of New York City, and they support writers and writers' projects. The Vermont Department of Corrections, which has been extremely supportive. We do a number of workshops in the corrections.
And we're going to go to that in just a little bit. But if you want to quickly run through your
support. The Vermont Association of Mental Health, Burlington Labs, the Ben and Jerry's Foundation, Barry and Peter Dreisacker, the Vermont Arts Council, Folks Design, Epiphany Magazine, Willard Cook, Sidney Lee, John Rosenblum, Susan Ritz, Nat and Martha Winthrop, and Jeffrey Kane.
We love you all.
We love you all. Thank
really
you.
Really helping a lot. We have a caller. Caitlin, what's on your mind? You have a question for Bess and Gary?
Yay! Hi. Yeah, I'm actually one of Gary's students.
Oh, good.
Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, Gary.
Thank you so much for calling in.
Sure. I love what you guys have said already.
What can you tell us about the experience, Caitlin?
Well, it's definitely helped me heal. You know, there's nothing like putting it down on paper, and like Gary had said, you know, the disease. Mm-hmm. My disease doesn't want me to, you know, open up and let things out, you know?
So that's the therapeutic effect that it has for you, is to just be able to put words to it and take it outside of yourself?
Right, so I can face it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Caitlin, this is Bess. How you doing?
Good.
Was it scary first starting when you first came in? And how did you hear about it?
Well, actually, my mother had seen an article in 7 days and told me about it, and when I first went, it was a little scary, but the first time I remember writing, and when I read my piece, I just cried. You know, it just felt so good. Anyone that's in recovery, you know, or even thinking about it, I recommend coming to the class and just trying it out.
It sounds like a really powerful experience. Caitlin, as you continued in the workshop, did the content and the things that you ended up addressing in your written work shift or change or develop in some way?
Oh, definitely. I've been clean and sober 4.5 years now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, things have changed. You know, when I first came in, it was just so raw, and I think now I talk more about just how good my life is.
Yeah, I just want to say, too, that I mentioned earlier, it's not really a writing class. We don't really, the goal is to help people with their recovery, not to help them become better writers, but people like Caitlin who really stick with it and show up. Caitlin, your writing has just gone places. It's amazing to watch her develop as a writer. She's a fantastic writer, and it's really been, I love you, too. I'm going to say it on the radio because it's true.
He's an amazing man and an amazing teacher.
It sounds like it. It sounds like an incredibly powerful experience. Caitlin, can I ask you just one more question? What was it like to be in a room full of strangers? I don't know, like, whether you were the same age or older or younger than a lot of the people in the room, or how different your situation was from theirs. But what was that like to kind of be in that room of folks you hadn't met before and being challenged to take this on?
It actually was great. You know, they are all ages. And as soon as they share their piece, I can usually relate to whatever they're writing. My daughter actually comes to the class, and she's not in recovery, but she's found it beneficial also.
Terrific. So is that another constituency that
Yeah, not a lot of folks who are, you know, we say anyone who's affected by recovery, and Caitlin's daughter, Sarah, has been a really great part of the workshop, although we are so proud of her now because she's in college and she's doing really well, so she has homework to do and she can't show up as much. But it's been really nice, you know, and as the, you know, the child of someone who has struggled with addiction, she had things she wanted to say, too, and it's been incredibly powerful to have her in there.
Right, yeah. And we should say that, too. The workshops are not open just to people who are, who are addicted themselves. It's open to family members. You know, we've had fathers and sons come. We've had, you know, parents. Parents need a lot of outlets to write about what they've gone through if their kid has been struggling with this disease. So those people are welcome, too.
It sounds like an amazing, amazing project. Caitlin, I really thank you for calling
us. Thanks, Caitlin.
Very much appreciated.
See you Wednesday.
That's great. Now, you've done workshops in the community. You've also done a couple at correctional institutes. Is that right? Can you tell me a bit about what that experience is like?
Yeah, we've done one at the Correctional Institute in St. Johnsbury, the Caledonia Men's Work Camp. That was last summer. I should say, when we say we did a workshop, we usually do a 10-week workshop, although the Burlington one has been ongoing. But usually we come in for 10 weeks. And so we've done 10-week workshops in Caledonia, the men's work camp, and also at Newport Correctional Facility. We did a great workshop up there, and we had a reading up there recently, which was fantastic, at the Newport Prison. And now we're starting a second 10-week workshop at Newport, and they've been fantastic.
Now, do you find that the content of the writing that gets done is similar or different if you're dealing with folks who are confronting?
You know, in some ways it's similar. There's a lot of, issues regarding addiction, but also particularly with the guys who are in prison. Subjects that come up a lot include family issues, you know, because they don't get to see their families as much as they'd like, obviously. And so there's a lot of issues, a lot of writing about family and how much they miss their family and how much they want to. And the other issue is how they understand that what they've done is wrong and they want to make things right. And that's a topic that comes up a lot in the prison groups, too. But they've been great.
Did you want to add something? You look like you had something on the tip of your tongue, Bess.
Well, I just think, once again, what it's awesome is that, people in prisons or even in the other workshops, not only do they write for 10 weeks, but then we do a reading, public reading. So they have to get up in front of their peers. In the correctional system, there were, people from prison, there were staff members, there were guards, there listening to them read in out loud these pieces that they had written, and it's very cathartic and it's very powerful. And so we really think that that's like, not only is it writing with each other, but then it's really sharing in front of your peers and other people.
My guests are Bess O'Brien and Gary Miller. We're talking about Writers for Recovery, a series of writing workshops that are focused on stories of addiction and recovery. Participants may be struggling with this themselves, or they may, it may touch their lives in other ways. Gary, what would you like to add?
I just wanted to add to what Bess said, that, you know, these public readings, they're for the, you know, the people who are in the group. I think they're very powerful. A lot of people have never stood up in front of an audience and ever, and they find the courage to do that. They're not required to do it, but most of them find, you know, they find the courage to do it. Some people ask their work to be read by other people. But that public component forms another big part of our program, which is really about going public and bringing people out into the community so people will begin to look at the stereotype of an addict and throw that away. When you look at someone stand up on a stage and read an incredibly well-written and incredibly emotionally powerful piece, that changes your mind about who an addict is. And that's really another big part of this program.
Yeah, we've done a couple of sort of bigger events. We've done a couple of readings at the Flying Stage in Barrie. One was our launch party for our book, and we did it with a big Bhangra
brass band, and over 200 people showed up. It was incredible.
We did a 20-minute reading of I think about 10 people who got up and read, and people, you know, you could hear a pin drop. And the point is, they were from all different backgrounds, sizes, shapes, you know, ages. And yes, Gary's right. In doing that, it just breaks all the stereotypes, and people say, "Oh my God, these people can do something other than just getting high." You know, it's like, they're real human beings. They have real stories. They're talented. They have something to offer to the world. Very important. Very important.
It's really exciting to listen to. I'm wondering if we can, we don't have too much more time. I'm wondering if we can hear another piece, if you could, because I find those really, really powerful. And
go
then
ahead,
after that, what I'd love to do is talk a bit about how, if you're listening and you would like to see this happen in a community that you are a part of, I'd like to hear from Bess and Gary about how you can do that. In the meantime, if you have a question or a comment for Bess or Gary about the Writers for Recovery workshop series, please give us a call here at 244-1777 or toll free 1-877-291-8255. You found one we can
hear? Yeah, there's another piece I'd like to read, and this is from the recovery section of the book. So it's about, you know, what life is like after you've made the decision to go into recovery. And this is actually the piece from which the book gets its title. And it's a piece by a great writer from also from our Burlington group named John Gower. It's called Why I Write for My Recovery. Remember when you were very young, lying alone in a field or park, and the clouds overhead somehow resonated in an idle sort of way with images and stories deep within your soul? Of course it was silly, but it still mattered, and mattered deeply. Writing for recovery is connecting with that very important silliness. Before we learned how not to be, it never occurred to us that we weren't wonderful. Writing for recovery gives us play and gives us heart. It suspends in midair the possibility of what might happen next. This unleashing of uncertainty moves us across the high wire, where balance only comes from moving the story along. One word followed by the next, we move our wonderful life forward while the crowd looks on in awe, and balance comes not by looking down or back, but from imagining where you're going next. Writing for recovery is recovering your balance. It is moving your life forward, one imagined word at a time.
Tremendous. That should be on the front of every brochure you publish.
I know.
Yeah,
it is.
and in fact, I just want everyone, in case they haven't, in case they just, you know, started listening, most of the pieces that are in this book were written in 7 minutes, which makes them even more amazing.
It's tremendous. It's really, really something. Where can the book be purchased?
On our website,
www.writersforrecovery.org.
Or you can go to Kingdom County Productions. You can also email me, bobrien@pshift.com, or call Kingdom County at 802-357-4616. We're looking for people who are interested in bringing us to their community or their health center or their treatment center. We're interested in people joining. We're interested in people helping to support us financially because we have to keep moving along with this.
If you want to learn more about Writers for Recovery and the writing process, we can also bring it to your organization.
Mm-hmm.
We do some great presentations for social service groups and other things.
We've done workshops at conferences, so it's a great way to get people thinking in a different way, a more creative way around all the different ways of recovering.
It sounds tremendous. Can you give that phone number and the email again?
Yes, 802-357-4616. That's Kingdom County Productions. Ask for Bess O'Brien. Or you can email me at bobrien@pshift.com.
Tremendous. Thank you both very much.
Thanks so much, Hester.
Thank you.
It's great talking with you this morning.
Well, we'll have you both back at some point and hear more about it. And maybe we can bring in one of your alums next
yes.
time.
Yes.
That would be fantastic.
Great.
That would be really terrific. You are listening to Open Mic here on WDEV. Hester Fuller is my name. I'll be with you until 11 o'clock, and I'll be back after these. Welcome back. You're listening to Open Mic here on WDEV. My name is Hester Fuller, and I am with you until 11 o'clock this morning. We've been chatting with Bess O'Brien and Gary Miller about the Writers for Recovery Project. What did you think, Tom? That was pretty powerful. Oh, I'm catching him off balance again. That was a pretty amazing thing to hear about, don't you think?
It is a nice thing when you see people get treatment, but instead of just being going to a facility or something, that there's more to it, and there's a more loving, nice process. So. It was very interesting.
It's also just so empowering to find put words to that sort of inchoate, crazy, lost, isolated feeling.
Can't imagine what that's, wouldn't want to.
Well, I can better imagine it now, having heard some of those pieces. And I think that's just really, anything that generates empathy, I think, is a wonderful, constructive thing to be doing. And this is pretty nifty. How have you been, my friend?
Doing
I haven't
good.
Seen you since Saturday night.
Yeah, it hasn't been. Oh boy, it's been a long time. Usually it takes a week or so. So, I was thinking that we went over to see Rusty's winter series
with
of Governor
Jim.
Douglas. And everyone talks about the actor that was the governor in, a couple of them, Ronald Reagan, and then also Arnold Schwarzenegger. I think they need some tips from our comedian slash actor slash, of course, Governor Jim Douglas.
Governor
I thought
Jim
he was
Douglas.
Great. He has, his wonderful. Voice was kind of scratchy, but he went right through it, and I thought he was great.
Yeah, he really was a trooper. He clearly had throat issues, but he was right up there. And I really liked the interplay between the two of them. I think that was kind of a genius pairing. I really think it was wonderful.
It was kind of, someone said the governor reminds me of Jack Benny, kind of that kind of, that dry, and good timing, though.
Very good timing.
You either have that or you don't,
I know.
And he has that.
Yeah,
so.
Well, I don't think you can get up on stage with Mr. DeWeese if you don't have good timing. He has the best timing I think I've ever seen. Jim Douglas, there's just an evenness about that guy. I miss that, I really miss having him around a lot.
And his book's interesting. I got a copy from my father, and he signed it for me. And I've been through it before, and it's different, but it's nice.
It was good. It was really good. We brought a whole mob down from Craftsbury.
Yeah, and you were featured in the show. They were
well,
kinda,
I wasn't, thank
well,
heavens.
No, I know, but they were... It was one
the
of those
introvert's
things.
That, nightmare.
Right. If you say something like, "Oh, hey, Rusty," he might use that against you later. So, in a good way.
Nah, he's a good guy.
Very interactive with the audience.
Yeah. We had a lot of fun. We really, really did. We made an evening of it. We dragged a bunch of folks. Us got together and came down and ate dinner, and went over and saw this, and it was just great. That whole series has been a good thing.
It
winds
a,
up this weekend. Still time, I imagine. I don't know for sure, but I would imagine there's still time to get tickets to the final.
And check it out, and I hope he does it again next year.
I really do too. It's just something about that—the vibe of that whole thing was just—it's unusual and really good and friendly and very Vermont.
Great time of year when we usually have cabin fever. We still kind of, but it's been warmer.
Yep.
But I remember when he thought about it in October, he said, "Well, here's what I'd like to do. Here's what I'd like to achieve, and bring the community together, if nothing else." And I think he scored there.
I think he has scored big time. I really hope that it comes back, and I hope it becomes kind of a regular feature of the winter season. It's nice to have something to look forward to every Saturday night for a whole big long stretch.
Yeah.
Really, really good. Well, we always like to ask on Monday mornings, what's on your mind out there? We had a couple calls earlier, and I'd like to have some more calls. I'd like to hear from some of my regulars, if you're listening. I'd love to hear what's on your mind, what you think of the news of the day, what you think about what happened, say, in South Carolina over the weekend, what your predictions are for the town meeting vote-a-thons tomorrow, budget-a-thons. Give us a call here at 244-1777 or toll-free 1-877-291-8255. Tom and I both would like to know what's on your mind, and we're just going to leave it there for you.
Sure. Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to tomorrow with the Super Tuesday. Might finally have a clearer picture of what's ahead between now and November.
Well, I'm interested, too, in the town school votes, you know, with Act 46 hanging over everybody, how that's going to go around the state, what's happening with budgets and what happens with community responses. I think a number of towns are going to do surveys of residents, towns that have not yet committed already to a plan for adapting to this mandate. I know we are in our town, and I know a number of the districts in our supervisory union will also be surveying residents to find out what they want, they want their boards to do.
Well, that's interesting. Like anything, you put something down on paper, and then, of course, you put it into practice, and more times than not, well, then there could be trouble. Mm-hmm. So then they have to go back, and hopefully they do.
That's the devil's always in the details. Yeah. It's tricky.
Well, I got to say something. Joel's coming in.
You've got some thoughts about what's going on in town meeting in your place, of course, WDEV is the epicenter of town meeting day reporting on the radio here in Vermont, and you can tune in tomorrow night. Polls close at 7, I think, statewide, and they're going to pull the hamsters out of their little sleeping cubicles and put them to work on the wheels, turning things on and getting the generators powered up and powering the radio station to deliver the results all tomorrow evening. It's going to be really tremendous. DEV does a great job, and I say that as a listener and a fan, as well as someone who comes in here Monday mornings to work. But it's really the go-to place on the air or online. You can check out the stream as well.
That's right. And, of course, we have, we always have to mention, we sometimes forget because we get busy, the podcast for Open Mic.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You want to tell people more about it?
No, I'm just,
so leave me hanging
put
there.
You on the spot. So now I'll do this, and I'm going to walk away for an hour. No, you just go on to our WDEV News Radio website, WDEV, and you go there, and then there's a bunch of you go to the Open Mic with Hester Fuller and Mike Smith, and you click on the open the microphone icon, and then they'll have the podcast by dates, and we usually get them up there by about noon for the new one.
Yep.
And, you can go back in time and listen to things, and kind of works good because a lot of people used to ask for copies, and that would become kind of difficult, so it's all
right there, and you can pull it down onto your smartphone or your dumb phone like I do, and tune in and listen.
You have a dumb phone? What's a dumb phone?
It only does what I tell it to.
Oh, I see.
It's really exasperating that way. Coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to be welcoming Eric Noose, who is a renowned hunter educator, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking a bit about the Vermont Deer Hunt. Tom, this is a show that, I mean, a segment that has grown directly out of things our listeners have said to us. We had a very lively program back in November, right before the start of rifle season, and we heard a lot of interesting and thoughtful, well thought out comments about how things are managed in the state of Vermont. And this is a chance to explore those topics in more depth. I don't pretend to know a lot about it, but I find it really, really interesting. I have responsibility for some hunting lands, and I like to hear different perspectives on ways that can be done better for the deer herd, better for the sport of hunting. And I think Eric Noose is just the guy to be here because he really knows what he's talking about, and he is also just an even-tempered guy, and we will hear some interesting stuff, I think, especially if we have calls from our listeners, which in my mind is really nine-tenths of the fun of being here. If you have a thought or a comment or even a suggestion for another show coming up, Eric will be here in about 10 minutes or so, but in the meantime, if you have thoughts about the news of the day or subjects that you would like to see taken up on this program, give us a call. Tom and I would love to hear from you, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255 if you're dialing toll free.
Sounds like our guest coming up after that will be after World and National News, Talk Media News.
Yeah.
And then this will be about 10, 15 minutes past.
Yes, that's right.
But we had the game wardens on last time, and they could give us more of the legal side with statutes and laws and whatnot. But sounds like our guest can do a wider spectrum.
He can, but, you know, if his name sounds familiar to you and you're not quite sure why, you know, that's he's a retired game warden himself. And you know wonderful series, Vermont Wild, Maine Wild, those little anecdotal tales of game wardens? Well, he put together the first one, or he's represented in... the Vermont Wild, the Wild book. So I'm hoping he brings a little tales for us as well. So I think that will be a lot of fun.
Good, good. And then we got Common Sense Radio, Bill Sayer.
Mm-hmm.
Did they give you a little list?
I haven't got it yet. Do you have that?
I have a list in
here. Tell me what they're going to be talking about.
Well, I don't know about today's show.
Not sure yet. Okay.
Well, no, I do know. I'm just sure if my father's going to be on.
Your dad's going to be on.
He's on with Bill quite a bit, and they're going to be talking about... how the lawmakers in Montpelier are going to be doing some legislation that might affect people who are working in the forest. So.
And is he a forester, your dad?
No.
So what's his connection
to
the topic?
Well, he represents the Forest Association. He's a lobbyist.
So, okay. All right.
But I like to pick on him. I always say, well, I don't know. If we Bill, you're kind of getting desperate for guests. So anyway, it looks like we have a phone call here, so I'm probably in trouble.
Good.
Hang on.
Well, let's just see who we've got here. Again, if you have thoughts or comments about what we're discussing this morning, or if you have ideas or topics that you'd like to see us address here on Open Mic, give us a call, 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. We will welcome you at the bottom of the off-ramp or the on-ramp and be glad to see you and glad to hear from you. We get a lot of our ideas for these programs from our listeners. Rob is on the line. Rob, where are you calling from?
I'm from Hinesburg. How are you?
I am fine. What's on your mind?
Well, I listen to you fairly regularly, and I have a particular interest in what how Craftsbury is responding to the school mandates in particular, since I and my firm were the architects for the project that you did up there a few years ago. And great fondness for the school and great admiration for all the work that people up there did to pull it together. And I'd like to hear what is sort of a selfish call in a way, but I'd like to hear how you're responding to it and what you're planning.
Well, I have to tell you, I feel a little awkward being on the other side of the question game. I think the thing to do is read the local coverage that's coming out in the Gazette and the Chronicle. I'm in a little bit of an awkward position because I have been a member of the school board, and I do not speak for the board when I'm speaking. We do that in a different way.
Right.
So I'm not trying to duck your question. It's just there are rules around things I can say publicly about what we are doing, and I would rather respect those rules because I think the system, the way it's always been, has been pretty effective.
Yeah. So, okay. Fair.
Can you tell me about Hinesburg? Now I'm just going to flip it on you. What's Hinesburg thinking?
Well, I'm going to find out more about that when we get to town meeting. I'm not involved heavily with the school here at all.
Which supervisory union are you part of up there? I don't really know.
Chittenden South.
Okay.
And so there, Hinesburg has its its own middle school and elementary school, the community school.
Yeah.
And then everyone troops off up the street to CVU.
Is your town's school budget affected by the cap controversy, the caps?
I think everybody's affected somewhat, but I think we're probably a little less so.
Mm-hmm.
Than what everybody else.
You are frugal up there in Hinesburg? You're not.
Well, I don't know. What we have had is to a small extent a slightly growing school population.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't hurt anything, and I think for at least for a little while that was the case up your way, where after the renovation, a lot of people felt more comfortable sending their kids to school there.
So. Mm-hmm.
Certainly helped with the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to follow up on that.
Well, I appreciate the call, and I think it is a topic, Act 46 and its impact on school governance structures around Vermont. It is certainly a topic we will be revisiting in coming weeks.
You know, we're going to be revisiting these things on a regular basis, I think, until we get it right. And, you know, as we all know, it's, you know, the legislative efforts to revamp school financing, which have occurred ever since, I think, what was it, almost ancient history now, the Miller Formula, have all been fraught with some sort of issue that has hampered their ability to do what they intended to do. And I think that I think fair game to say, well, okay, that didn't work, let's try again, if in fact it didn't work. But the other thing that is in, I mean, all well and good to consolidate, I think, but assuming that it makes sense for the local communities, but Vermont is diverse in its layout of terms of town boundaries and town's proximity to one another, and in terms of what makes sense geographically.
Mm-hmm.
And these areas form, you know, almost communities by watershed, and if you will, and they need to maintain that sort of identity, and the kids, I think, are better off to some, many of them anyway.
You know, that's, you raise a really good point there, and as and someone who's involved in architecture, you probably actually noted this or incorporated it, but isn't it so that when a new kind of open space is laid out, the smart designer will wait and see where the paths are naturally worn before they will go down and lay the asphalt or whatever it is to surface
certainly,
them?
Certainly that's true to a certain extent. I mean, there's been some very interesting studies for where you have buildings around a town square or something like that, and if you take a little aerial shot of it in the wintertime where people walk in the snow, it's pretty interesting.
Yep, and I think it tells you something about habits and traffic and patterns and things that are natural that are going to, that you could work with as opposed to try to contravene.
Yeah, you definitely always, to the extent you can, want to, within the constraints of, you know, materials that you have to work with and money and all of that, you have to you try to work with your environment particularly and try to make it, actually try to enhance it. And, you know, we're, the great thing about architecture as a profession of late is this effort to expand it from just the layout into how does this relate to the environment and what materials are you using and how much energy are you using and how does that affect things longer term. And so it's, you know, working with Craftsbury was fabulous.
Now, were you involved in the gym project?
Oh, yeah, and the academy
project. Okay, Minden Hall.
So we did all of the, well, the main, the old building.
Yeah.
Not the original, not the...
But the big building with the cupola.
The original, the oldest building to which the gym is attached.
Mm-hmm.
And the adjacent building on where the lockers are now.
Yeah, that gym is a wonderful story. It's a wonderful story about community. That's the gym where the floor was all donated lumber from folks.
Harry Miller and I sat down and said, well, how are we going to work to get the community involved? And figured it out, and Harry ran with it.
He certainly did, and the town owes a great debt to Harry Miller because of the ways he's been able to get stuff organized and make stuff happen. And that gym floor is something that everybody in town is very, very proud of.
Yep. You know, we were overwhelmed with how well it turned out and the spirit it's brought back to people. So it's great.
Cool. It is. Listen, Rob from Hinesburg, I really appreciate your call, and we'll see if we can rope you in again to talk a little bit more about these design and integration with the environment questions. It sounds like you've done some serious thinking about that, and I think it's an interesting topic. We have to let you go now because we're going to have to pause in just a few moments to take a quick look at the news, and then we will also be joined by our regular correspondent from, I think she'll be in Washington this week, I'm not sure, the folks from Talk Media News, and we will get a chance to ask some questions and hear what they are thinking about. As Tom mentioned just a while ago, we will be continuing with open mic up until about 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and then at 11, it'll be time for Bill Sayers and the Ethan Allen Institute's program. And his guest this week is a forestry lobbyist.
Yeah, well, he does a lot of different lobby things. But Steve McLeod, my dad, will be in.
And it'll be an interesting program as well.
It should be entertaining.
Yep, and coming up on the other side of our news break, we're going to welcome Eric Noose. He has been a consultant, a writer, and an educator. He's executive director of the Hunters Institute, Orion, the Hunters Institute, and he is a retired game warden, and we're going to be revisiting the topic, the ever-popular topic of the Vermont deer herd and the Vermont deer hunt. So stay tuned. You are listening to WDEV, broadcasting from Warren, Vermont at 96.1 FM, also from Barrie, Vermont at 96.5 FM, and from our flagship station in Waterbury, Vermont, AM 550, the Nifty 550. You can also hear us worldwide now. We stream on the internet, and you can find our live stream at WDEV.com. We'll see you on the other side. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Hester Fuller with you until 11 o'clock this morning. In just a few minutes, we're going to be cutting away to Washington. Our friends from Talk Media News will be ringing in. And before they do, I wanted to take a minute to squeeze in a little bit of an announcement or promotion for the wonderful WDEV annual Winter Croquet Tournament coming up Saturday, March 12th, 2016. It's a long-standing tradition here at Radio Vermont. We ask you to come on out and join us and play croquet in the snow or whatever's left over there by the time we get out there. Saturday morning, March 12th, you need to plan to come on down there by, say, 7:15, 7:30 or so. Announcements and instructions will be given at 7:45, and play should begin at around 8 o'clock. If you want to bring a team, we do have the fabulous WDEV Rotating Trophy, which has recently spent a year down at Annapolis because the Navy guys won this tournament a few years back. But it's back, and it's your chance to have that glorious piece of kit standing in the display window at your place of business if you'd like to. So if you would be interested in forming a team, drop us an email. Get in touch with the station. 244-7321 is the basic downstairs number, and let us know that you would like to take part in the Winter Croquet Tournament 2016, Saturday, March 12th, early in the morning. Right now, though, we're going to jump to Washington, I believe, and talk with our friend Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Victoria, are you in Washington this morning?
I am in Washington this morning, yes.
So did you spend the weekend watching the developments in South Carolina?
Some of them, and some of the time. Some of the other time I was watching Hollywood-type developments, and some of the time I did that, yes.
So what is the buzz there this morning in the wake of all that?
Well, I'm afraid to say that your guy got decimated, and he himself will admit that.
Yes, he will. But we saw that coming, you know, and he was out preparing the road ahead. That's the way we're looking at it here.
Yeah, he was definitely preparing the road ahead and is hoping for a better result tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
including in your own state.
Yeah, we do expect him to do pretty well here.
Yeah.
We're pretty loyal to our local fellas.
And he's hoping for a good result in Minnesota and Massachusetts and maybe Oklahoma. I think he's hoping to do well in possibly. So we'll see about some of those places. There are some places he's not expecting to do terribly well in: Alabama, Tennessee, Arkansas, Georgia. I don't think he's even thinking he's going to do terribly well in Virginia, really.
Well, we'll just have to see what happens there. On the other side of the card, yet another weekend of kerfuffle around Mr. Trump and these endorsements from various shady characters. Is there much talk about that down there?
Yeah, nonstop talk about that around there. The latest is that today he's saying on the Today Show that he's blaming his failure to denounce David Duke, the former Klansman and current white supremacist, yesterday on a lousy earpiece.
Yep. A poor craftsman blames his tools, though.
Yeah, well, he's done this several times during the campaign. This is a go-to excuse for him. And this is what he said this morning. So it was a lousy earpiece. He said it was various groups I heard. Well, that actually won't wash. And I'll tell you why it won't wash. Because not only is it because it's a go-to excuse of his, so it just doesn't wash because he always says this. And he also said yesterday on CNN this. Well, just so you understand, I don't know anything about David Duke, okay? I don't even know what you're even talking about with white supremacy or white supremacists. So if he couldn't hear, how is it that he could hear David Duke, white supremacy, and white supremacists?
Yeah,
if he couldn't hear.
Yeah, there's no end to it, I'm afraid, at least for the time being. And we'll just have to see what happens on Super Tuesday, and I look forward to chatting with you next week. Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. We will be back in just a moment with Open Mic. My guest, Eric Noose, is here. We'll be talking about the deer herd and the deer hunt. So if you've got your dialing finger greased up, start poking away. 244-1777 or toll-free 1-877-291-8255. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're tuned to WDEV and the Open Mic program. Hester Fuller is my name, and I'll be with you for the next hour. The topic this hour is one I know is popular with a number of our listeners. We're talking about the deer herd and the deer hunt here in Vermont. If you have thoughts about this and opinions you'd like to share with our guest, who I will introduce in just a moment, take down these numbers, 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. And now it is my great pleasure to welcome Eric Noose, who is a consultant, I guess it's fair to say, and a former game warden himself. And Eric, I'm going to let you introduce yourself to our listeners.
Well, thank you, Hester. It's fun to be here again. I guess, you know, my connection with deer hunting is I've hunted deer a long, long time since I was young, and I'm not quite so young anymore. I went to the University of Maine and got a degree in wildlife management and got lucky enough to get hired here in Vermont as a game warden back in 1971.
And I should mention that that interval in your life is amusingly chronicled in pieces anyway in the Vermont Wild book, the selection of this state, fill in your favorite state, wild books about hunting and game warden stories.
That's true, because things were a little different back in the 70s than the wardens are involved with now. I mean, the overall mission was very similar, but we didn't have any of the communications that we have now, and essentially most of us said we work for ourselves, but we're paid by the state. So we had a lot of flexibility on what to do and how to get our job done. Mm-hmm. So that made for some amusing times occasionally.
Well, we're here today to talk about the 2015 deer hunt here in the state of Vermont. We did a program on this back in November, actually right before the rifle season began, and had a lot of callers call in with some pretty strong opinions about how the herd is managed in Vermont and how things in the northern part of the state, where most of our listeners are usually hunting, maybe aren't responding in the anticipated way to some of the policies that the state has put in place. And so I wanted to invite you in here so we could talk a little bit about that and encourage our listeners, particularly the hunters in our audience, to give us a call and share some of those perspectives as well. The only report I've seen was an article that came out in, what am I looking at here, is it the Berkshire Eagle? Talking about, and this comes out of Bennington, early counts on Vermont's 2015 deer harvest, which came out, this article was published in early January, actually, so I'm sure there are more current numbers, that the hunt is seen as reflecting a pretty stable buck population in the state of Vermont. Is that a goal?
Definitely it is. The deer herd in the last 10 to 15 years is so much more resilient and healthy than it was when I first came on as a warden. Some of the old-timers out there probably remember the bad old days, even though it's easy to forget the bad old days and think about the good stuff that happened. But when I first got here in Lamoille County in 1972. I took over for Red Hooper, who'd been the warden for 40 years. And Red used to tell me stories of when he was a youngster, how in Lamoille County, most people didn't own a deer rifle because there was not enough deer to actually have that kind of expense. So during the deer season, if you found a buck track in the snow, you would go to the hardware store, rent a rifle, and then you go back on that track and you would stick on it until you saw whether it was a buck or a doe, and hopefully it was a buck, and maybe you would get a chance to shoot it. But there was no sense leaving that track because the odds of finding another one weren't very good. So you just think about those days. I mean, that was definitely the bad old days. That was when we were really trying to restore deer, and we had a lot of restrictive laws, bucks only, et cetera, and no archery, no muzzleloader, none of that stuff. But even when I got here in the early 70s, we had some really tough winters. The biologists had been predicting we had too many deer, that they were in poor shape, and that our wintering areas were in really bad shape. And I remember that first winter that I was here in 72, the winter of 72, we did a dead deer search, and they found more dead, starved deer per square mile than they'd ever found in the United States.
Now, this was statewide, or were there particular
regions? That was this in this one area, but it was pretty clear statewide that it was pretty bad. The deer, it was a long, hard winter, a lot of snow, a lot of cold, took a lot of energy, and the deer had to live on the fat that they came into that yarding area for the whole winter, and it lasted a long time. Mm-hmm. Now, we didn't have the number of coyotes we have now, so we found a lot of carcasses. Now they get cleaned up a lot faster. But it was really clear that things were really bad. But you know, a lot of the hunters remembered the days of scarcity, like Red had talked about, and they didn't quite believe it. One of the issues with a fair number of hunters is they're in the woods in the fall, but they're not in the woods year-round, and they don't see what goes on, and it's kind of hard. I mean, even this time of year, we had two deer walk by my picture window this morning, and so we're looking at them, naturally, and my wife commented, boy, they looked like they're in good shape. And I said, well, they ought to be. I mean, this has been the easiest winter we've had in a long time as far as snow and cold goes, which are the big factors, and I'm sure they're going to break out of the yards, probably already started to. But when you look at a deer this time of year, they've got really thick hair, and it's sort of like looking at a sheep. Unless you really know what you're looking at, the unshorn sheep, you're not going to know whether that's a fat animal or not. And I think we fall into that. You know, mm-hmm. You see them, they look all puffy, you say, oh, they're great. Well, they could be skin and bones under that.
Is there any sense this year yet of whether that is? This has been a pretty mild winter, and there has been ample forage.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any question this is going to be a really good year. The other thing is the deer went into this winter in great shape. Some areas had really heavy beech nut crops. Acorns were pretty abundant, and we had apples everywhere. One guy was telling me, he says, the only apple trees that don't have apples on them this year are dead apple trees. I think he's pretty darn right.
I think it's been a good cider season as well. My guest is Eric Noose, who is a consultant now and a former game warden. We're talking about the deer herd, and if you have thoughts about the Vermont herd, about your experience as a hunter in Vermont and how it has changed over time, about the management policies for the herd and the wildlife recreation areas in the state of Vermont, give us a call at 244-1777 or toll free 877-291-8255. Now, Eric, for folks who are new to the state or new to hunting and who may not really know the sort of logistics of policy here, how the state's divided up into regions, is that correct for the purposes of managing the herd?
Well, it's actually divided finer than that. We have wildlife management areas.
Units, that's right.
Units. So we've got a bunch of them. It makes it so that they can fine-tune regulations a lot more than it used to be when most of the laws were statewide. Because, it's quite different from the Northeast Kingdom compared to Bennington County, say.
Yeah, a lot of our callers from last November do hunt in Lamoille County or in the Northeast Kingdom. One of the problems that I've heard mentioned repeatedly, not just here, but, you know, at the gas station and the general store, hunter density seems to be on the uptick. And there just seem to be more hunters in various places than folks are used to seeing or than folks feel the herd can support.
Yeah, well, it's true. Our deer get a lot of pressure, which makes them really wild. I mean, they know people are danger, and they pick it up real quick, especially as soon as the rifle season starts, and their habits change considerably. But that's kind of the way it is. We've got a lot of roads. We don't have a lot of big roadless areas, but there are still places you can get back in, no question, which is the kind of places I love to go. There may be a few less deer, but there's a lot less people also, and the deer are acting a little bit more natural back in there. But, you know, that's a plus and a minus in a way, because Fish and Wildlife Department really depends on license sales. If we have less hunters, they've got less money to do management work, enforcement work, all kinds of stuff.
And I think that's a topic that's likely to pop up in callers' concerns in just a minute. Right now, we have a call from Tom in Berlin. Tom, what's your question?
Yeah, morning. Well, I mean, it's just more an observation. I mean, he talks about the lean ovia. So I'm 55. I haven't hunted in quite a few years. My brother and his family and kids, they haven't bought a Vermont license in years. They all have a camp in northern Maine and either end up there or Ontario or Ohio or whatever. But you say Leno years, but why, if that's the case, then why was the final buck total so much more than they are today? And I'll just hang up and listen.
You're talking about the buck count early back in the lean years. You're saying it's higher than it's been.
Yeah, I'm glad to answer that as best I can. The big difference was, first of all, we had a spike law. You know, your legal deer had to have a spike 3 inches or longer. So now we've got an antler restriction because the hunters told the department they would prefer to hunt for older deer with a little bit bigger racks. So a lot of deer were given an extra year to be alive. But the biggest factor was the number of deer we had in the bad old days, at least most of the time. The deer herd was twice as big as it is now. But unfortunately, that was an anomaly. It grew like mad in the 50s and 60s because of our old farms growing up, and we had this wonderful early succession habitat that was just perfect for white-tailed deer. Unfortunately, the wintering areas didn't keep up with that. And so the overall health of our deer herd back then was really poor. So when we had a bad winter, we had huge starvation and really low reproduction. Part of that a lot of folks never saw was that the does, when they were running out of food in the winter, they were pregnant, of course, they would start to reabsorb their embryos. So we had a really low reproduction rate also. So yes, we had some high antler or buck kills, but a lot of them were pretty small deer, not very healthy deer, very few bigger racks, and way less resiliency to environmental and weather type problems, especially in the winter.
We're chatting with Eric Noose about Vermont's deer herd and Vermont's deer herd management policy and other questions about hunting the white-tailed deer here in the state of Vermont. If you have a question or a comment, or you'd like to pick up where we left off last November, give us a call at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. The matter of the number of licenses that are issued, it does seem like there's a bit of a conflict there between if the state is that reliant on the license fees to keep their operations, their management operations going, that seems like there's an incentive to issue lots and lots of licenses.
Well, there certainly is efforts to recruit hunters for various reasons. One is the money, no question about that. We do get a lot of federal funds in the states, but those are reliant on hunters too. A lot of it's the excise tax on arms and ammunition and bow equipment that comes back to the state, Pittman-Roberts money. But that is reliant somewhat on number of hunters you have in your state. We're kind of lucky being a small state. We get a minimum. So we actually get a higher proportion than some of the big states like Pennsylvania or Ohio. But the other issue is support for hunting. If you have more people that actually are involved or are associated with people that hunt, it's a lot easier to support wildlife management and some of the things that are important, and especially habitat and preservation of wild and open spaces and keeping land open to be able to hunt on. Mm-hmm. As that percentage gets lower, it gets politically harder and harder to support things that we care about here in Vermont. So I think we're really lucky that way. So to me, overall, it's a huge plus to have more hunters.
More hunters and more people who are environmentally attuned to the contribution that or the benefit they get out of living.
Exactly. And a lot of hunters, you know, they're out there. They're, you know, most hunters, like a deer hunter, they're scouting year round. They might not be out of their car in the woods all the time, but they're looking and they're talking and they know stuff that's going on. You know, some could do more for sure and be a little broader in their views of what's happening with wildlife. But, you know, I think that's a big issue.
Pete from Barrie, you're on the on the air with Eric News. What's your question?
Yes, good morning. I was, as you were mentioning a moment ago there, about getting back in the woods. With the advent of mountain bikes, ATVs, snowmobiles, all these intrusions into the forest year-round, what kind of effect, if any, does it have on our deer population? But also, what kind of effect does it just have on the general health of forests? I'll get off the line and wait for your answer.
That's a great question.
Well, there's no question that unrestricted ATV use can be really detrimental to a lot of habitats, particularly wetlands. And it's really pretty sad and irresponsible the way some of these manufacturers advertise their products. Even with the four-wheel drive trucks, gives the inclination or the indication that, you know, you can go anywhere and mud's good and all that. But the reality is that's really detrimental. The other overall effect, I think, of a lot of these ways to get back in is that it essentially shrinks what we have for wild lands. You know, if it only takes you 15 minutes to get up to the ridge on your ATV, that's kind of nice. You get a chance to hunt a little bit more. But if you have to walk up there and it takes an hour, it seems bigger. So we shrink what we've got. And in Vermont, I think that's kind of important. So I'm not, you know, opposed to ATV use when it's, you know, on designated trails and responsible riding, but we need to keep places for the folks that have the energy and really like solitude and back in. We need to keep those safe too, and there's a lot less of them. I'm part of on the board of directors of a new organization in the East called the New England chapter of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And that's one of their core missions, is to keep wildlands wild and roadless areas that way. So we work hard at that.
So, and that's a regional, it sounds like it's a regional.
It's regional for the chapter, but it's a national organization, that formed originally in the West, in Oregon and Montana. And their big fight out there actually is keeping public lands public, because there's a lot of push from certain politicians to turn federal lands over to the state, and then the state pressure for money is to go ahead and sell them, and they end up in the hands of Ted Turner types that have huge ranches that are all posted, and the democracy of the hunt pretty fast.
We'll be returning to the topic of policies governing the management of lands where wildlife are to be found, and conflicting priorities where those are concerned. But right now, let's go out to Newberry. Fred, you're on the air with Eric.
Oh, hi. How are you guys today?
We're great. How are you?
Pretty good. Hey, you know, you talk about backwoods hunting. I don't believe in all my hunting I've ever seen a backwoods hunter. No such thing as a backwoods hunter.
Well, of course you don't see them. They're out in the backwoods.
No, because I was out in the backwoods. Here's my definition of a backwoods hunter. A backwoods hunter has to be out in the backwoods where there's no line of communication to get out there. So this guy is up on the ridge. He said it took him 2 hours to get up on that ridge. I'll bet you a buck was on a road going up that back ridge, because if he shot a deer up on that back ridge without a road, going through a trackless wood, I don't think he'd be able to bring the deer down. What do you think?
Well, it's definitely harder. And, you know, it's sort of like moose hunting. If that's the kind of hunting you want to do, you need to plan ahead. And that could be that you're going to get a buddy up there to help you. It could be that you've got yourself a frame pack, so like the guys that elk hunt out west, you don't bring the deer out whole. You quarter it up, and maybe you have to hang half of it to come back in and get. You know, we do have a lot of log roads, no question about it, in Vermont, some of which are cut out and others aren't. You know, you got to plan ahead. We're lucky here in Vermont. Some of the back country guys out in, say, Montana, you better be moving that elk real fast or you're going to have a grizzly bear on it. Here our black bears aren't quite so aggressive and on protecting carcasses, so we've got it a little easier. But, you know, I used to laugh that checking licenses when I was a warden, you know, you're lucky to check a license more than 150 yards from a road, particularly non-resident guys. You know, they're a little spooked, I guess, about our big country. But amazingly, when you have snow on the ground, I don't know if this is your experience, but you can get back in and you'll find tracks if there's been snow on the ground very long. We still have a lot of guys that like to get back in. I hunted Butternut and Laraway Mountain this year. And there wasn't a corner that if the snow had been on the ground 2 or 3 days that I didn't find at least one track. And it's true, I didn't see any hunters, which was fine with me. But they didn't see me either, so it was okay with me.
Thanks for your call. Frank from Burlington, you're on the air with Eric Noose. What's your question?
Frank?
Yep, Frank.
Oh, yeah, okay, sorry, I was trying to get my phone going.
That's okay.
Just a quick question, it said earlier that one of the reasons that the deer herd is down is because of winter kill. And my question is that why doesn't Vermont allow landowners and farmers to feed deer in the wintertime to keep them going as they do in New Hampshire and Maine?
Okay.
And, I think that would certainly increase the herd and make them a healthier group.
Yep. Well, the reality is in modern times, the winter kill hasn't been a huge factor. It is a factor, and the department monitors it very closely, and that's where they set their antlerless deer seasons. So like this year, because we'd had two severe winters in a row, not this winter, but the winters before, they lowered the number of permits during the muzzleloader season for antlerless deer by about, I think it was 40% or so. So the reality is that we have a smaller deer herd now because we manage it. We want it to be smaller. We need it to be in balance with the environment. And particularly the winter area. There's other factors, but that's kind of the critical one. So right now the deer herd is well within the management criteria. The biologists feel is healthy. Obviously, that always has to be monitored. As far as the winter feeding, we actually only recently outlawed that. And primarily it was because of disease transmission. And especially the concerns about chronic wasting disease.
But we don't actually have that in Vermont yet.
No, we don't have it. But it's spooky. I mean, we've got it around us. We had a real scare a few years ago with a captive herd that got out in the Adirondacks, and it was found that they did have chronic wasting disease. But fortunately, it appears that that those animals were able to catch up with them, and it didn't spread, probably because of really low deer populations in the Adirondacks. And so far, as far as we know, we don't. But we just wanted to be ahead of the curve. and also included in that is the new ban this year on deer urine that hunters use for attraction, deer does in heat.
Natural fluids.
Right, because it's got those prions in it. And they're pretty sure that that's one method of transmission. And it gets into the soil and it stays a long time.
Yeah. One of the things that I hear often again around the general store and the gas station is people have questions about why hunters are allowed to take as many animals over the course of the successive seasons as they are. Why isn't there just sort of a limit? You get your deer in bow season, then you're done. Or you wait to get it in rifle season, you're done.
Well, it's all about, overall. The biologists look at the overall picture, not necessarily the individual, and they say this is what we can sustain for buck hunting, and especially antlerless hunting, because that's the one that really controls the population. And then that gets balanced with opportunity. Because no matter what you hear, bottom line, for most hunters that stick with it, the kill is great. I mean, that's sort of the gravy. But what you really enjoy is the hunt. Because if you don't enjoy the hunt, you're probably not going to hunt in Vermont very long. Because I think it's, averages like 15% of our deer hunters every year, are successful as far as killing a deer. But I would say probably 95% of our deer hunters are very successful in their hunt because they have a good time. And that's the bottom line. So I think if you keep that in mind, you begin to understand this idea, and obviously you enjoy the hunt the most when you're hunting. So if you have more time and more opportunity, you can go out. A surprising thing to me when we put in the antlerless restrictions, you know, I was kind of, I don't care about big antlers. Yeah, I like a bigger deer just like everybody does, but I'm happy with, you know, during the antler season with a nice big fawn. I mean, it's great eating. But what I found was it made my buck hunting during the rifle season much more enjoyable because I love to track and I like to move around. And I was finding deer sign midway all the way at the end of the season, buck sign, you know, scrapes. Just knowing that it was a buck from the tracks and stuff, and it just kept my interest up a little more, because we know, 50% of the bucks generally are shot that opening weekend or right around that time, so your odds get less and the bucks get smarter, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So it just adds to the enjoyment. So I think it's that balance between opportunity and actual harvest. And we find, that when we had, when you could take three deer during the season, they've restricted that a little bit more now during the archery and muzzleloader season, where you can only take two and you can only take one buck, et cetera, there was very few people that were actually killing three deer. Mm-hmm. There were certain families and certain groups, and, you get all this sort of how did they do that kind of deal, especially when I'm having a heck of a time getting one. But it enabled them to be out there a little bit longer, and the actual impact on the resource was very minimal. Mm. So it's sort of a social thing, and I think the department has learned a heck of a lot since I started with letting the hunters and the majority of the folks decide these social sort of issues, and we stick to the biology now.
We're talking with Eric Noose about Vermont's deer harvest in 2015, Vermont's deer herd, and the Vermont deer hunt. And we'll be back with Open Mic after these words. Good morning and welcome back. This is Open Mic. My name is Hester Fuller. We're on the air Mondays 9 to 11. And my guest this hour is Eric Noose, who has done many things in the world of hunting and hunter education. In fact, Eric, we were just talking about your perspective and the breadth of your experience, which I kind of was half aware of. Maybe you could recap for our listeners just what are the different angles from which you've looked at the question of the deer herd and wildlife land management?
Yeah, I've been lucky. I've had a lot of different kind of jobs. I like to laugh that even within the Fish and Wildlife Department, without really much for promotions, I've been able to have three separate jobs there. I started off in law enforcement, but I had a biology background, which actually made the law enforcement guys a little nervous at first. But then I moved into hunter education and outdoor education, and got a chance to work with a lot of great groups and start programs like the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program and Outdoor Family and cool stuff like that, and work in our conservation camps. So I got a chance to really delve into hunter ethics and hunter safety and teaching techniques and how to reach a lot of people. And then I got nominated to be part of the leadership and management program. So I was working with management, which was a lot of fun, too.
And then you came to the attention of folks on a bigger stage, I gather.
Well, that's true, because we, especially in hunter education, because my boss and I, John Capusta, were pretty innovative. We tried to come up with a lot of different ways to teach people and to be inclusive and not just focus on, say, the kid that wanted to hunt, but on his mother.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us some examples of the kinds of that I know about the hunts women?
Yeah, well, a lot of it was just to invite the parents into the class, and some of my instructors actually made it mandatory for certain ages, because, in Vermont, we don't have a minimum age when you can hunt, which made it pretty tough for my instructors. You had some gung-ho 7-year-old, but were they really ready? Mm-hmm. A lot of times, probably not, maybe mentally, but not physically, or vice versa, or both, but they wanted to hunt. So it was great to have the parents in there that were, going along with the kid and have them see that, A, the child probably wasn't quite ready for that kind of responsibility, but B, to educate them. Mm-hmm. And then they were ready to say to the kid, well, you can come along and hunt. We'll let you carry your BB gun, but we're going to wait a little while. And we're not going to even bother taking the test here because you're doing great, but, you're not going to hunt anyway, and, we'll go out and do it. But big things that we did in Hunter Ed was to make them way more hands-on. We used to, when we first, Hunter Ed became mandatory in 1974, We had huge groups of people that needed to be trained, so we had these big auditoriums and lectures and show a movie and take a test and out the door you went. Never touch a gun, a lot of them. And now we just say, how can you do that? You know, yeah, that's how do you know that they're going to be safe if you've never seen them handle or had them practice? So now it's way more interactive, and we do a lot of the knowledge part online where they can use these interactive tools. And then they come to a field day where they get a chance to really practice. And a lot of our guys run hybrid courses where you come, you get an introduction, you get the handle, you have some discussions, and then you go do the online or the home study paper course, and then you come back to a field day. Mm-hmm. And you get a chance to practice and be coached. And if you meet the standards, which generally is, would the instructor go hunt with you? Mm-hmm. Which is a pretty good standard.
That is a very good standard.
And as long as they can articulate why they want, that's fine. The guys will stand behind them and say, come back next time. You're not quite ready. Here's why, kind of thing. So anyway, we got it. Because we got known for that nationally, I ended up actually getting recruited to be the head of the International Hunter Education Association out of Wellington, Colorado. And it was a chance to go on more of a national scale and highlight these kind of things. We did a lot of trainings with coordinators around the U.S., and a lot of coordination, and that's where we move forward in a strong way with the online course. And I got to see a lot of different issues around the U.S., so it gave me a little broader perspective, mm-hmm. you know, especially the Western perspective, where they're still dealing with, you know, way more people want to hunt elk in Utah than they can allow to hunt elk. Mm-hmm. So they have to have permit systems, and they come up with all these ways to try to do a fair allocation of the resource, which makes for lots of issues. Mm-hmm. So it's not like the overabundance of white-tailed deer that, say, we have in Chittenden County or Franklin, maybe. They have to deal with different issues. Mm-hmm. But the underlying principles, which we call the North American model of wildlife conservation, still apply, you know, but different aspects of it kick
Let's
in.
Talk a bit about that. I want to remind folks that my guest is Eric Noos, who's a hunter educator and a former game warden, and we've been talking about the Vermont deer herd and the Vermont deer hunt, and we welcome your calls and comments and questions. 244-1777 1-877-291-8255 will get you to us toll free, and we love to hear from you, so please give us a call if you would. Oh, it just went out of my head. What were we just talking about that we wanted to develop?
Well, the North American model of wildlife conservation.
That's it. Yeah, you were talking about the principles that are underlying that. What are those kinds of principles?
Well, the founding principle, really. First of all, it's a historic construct. It's not something that somebody thought of 100 years ago and said, okay, we got to do these seven principles. If we do that, we're going to restore our wildlife. We're going to have our success. It's going to be great. But the founding one actually came to us from England, from the Magna Carta, and it was that wildlife is a public trust resource, that it's owned by everybody, held in trust, originally by the king. When we threw the king out, we decided it was us, the government. The government would be the trustee, and for the resident game, it would be the state. For migratory animals, it would be the federal government. And it would be held in trust for future generations to enjoy. And that meant we had to think long term, and we had to do it what would be right for the future. And that led to all kinds of good things. And that was from common law and from Supreme Court decisions. And in some cases, the ability to harvest these animals was enshrined in state constitutions, like Vermont. Ours was there right from the get-go, 1777, the ability to hunt during seasonable times, and it was right there.
We have a caller who would like to check into the conversation. Terry from Moncton, you're on the air with Eric Noos.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
Very good, thanks. You're a little soft, but...
Yeah,
I have a question regarding coyotes. I moved out here about 12 years ago from California, and I always had coyotes around. Some of them were huge. I had some on my ranch that looked more like huge German shepherds. They were gorgeous animals. And I found out later why. They would chase the chickens who ran loose. They'd chase them off the nest and they'd eat the eggs. They never ate the chickens. They were too smart for that.
Don't kill the golden goose.
Yeah. But since I've come to Vermont, there's a real hatred here. and a fear of coyotes. And I don't get it. That's a cowardly little animal that eats the sick and kills the weak, and that's about it. They'll run from any normal-sized dog or anything else. But I find that people have stories about, well, there are fewer deer because coyotes are eating them all. And I'm just wondering, as from your expertise, what impact do the coyotes really have? And I'll listen to your answer. Thank you very much.
Great question, Terry. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, coyotes, people are really interested in them. Coyotes, wolves, all that kind of stuff. Any of our predators, really. And, you know, I it's hard to know where this kind of fear and kind of about especially coyotes comes from, because it's not founded in facts for sure. I mean, there's been so few human attacks by coyotes that it's just about zero. I mean, way more from domestic dogs overall. You know, the last one I remember for coyotes was down on Cape Cod, where a coyote came out and grabbed a little toddler, but then got spooked off. The good thing in Vermont, I think, with our predators is that we have long, inefficient hunting seasons for them. And that's primarily coyotes and bear. It's a little counterintuitive to think that if the more you hunt them, the more you can live with them, but it's true. These critters, just like you said, most of them run away from a dog. But in some areas where there's no hunting and no trapping for these critters, they do get pretty bold. Because what the heck, you know, these people and dogs have never bothered them before. You know, if I can get away with something or I'm bigger than that dog, why not? Especially because of hounding. Some folks don't like that idea, but the fact is that these critters learn that people and dogs are dangerous, and if they're smart, they'll stay away from them, and if they hear them or see them, they'll skedaddle quick. So consequently, especially with bears, we can live with a high population of bears and not have much for trouble.
I'm talking with Eric Noose, and we're talking about the Vermont deer herd and the various forces that impinge upon its survival and continuation. And we will be back to wrap up, I guess, but we have a little bit of business to do, and stay tuned to Open Mic. Good morning and welcome back to Open Mic. Hester Fuller is my name. I'm with you every Monday from 9 until 11. My guest this morning is Eric Noose, hunter educator and a hunter expert on all kinds of matters. And part of that, that expertise stems from one of your early positions in the field, as it were. You were a game warden for a while, weren't you?
I was. I was in the field 16 years in Lamoille County.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Tell us about that.
Well, like I mentioned, it was sort of the old days when you had a lot of freedom. And, you know, it brings to mind, you know, now we have wildlife rehabilitators. So when we get a call from people that they've got an orphan animal, et cetera, the wardens have somebody to take it to if they can do it. Some for disease reasons and stuff, you can't do that. But in the old days, we didn't have that. And matter of fact, the training was that, you know, somebody called in with a bunch of, say, orphan raccoons. You would take them from them if you couldn't, you know, for sure they were orphaned. There wasn't a mother around someplace. And you'd go around the corner and you'd whack them with a shovel because we had no way to take care of them. But it was, I hated that. So a lot of us, because we were a little resourceful and the supervisors weren't watching all that close and they didn't like it much either, had people that would help us raise these. And one story that's in that Vermont Wild book you noted was about raccoons. And we had the Boy Scout camp up in Mount Norris there on Lake Eden. Those guys, the counselors, were really good at helping me raise raccoons. And this one time I had a bunch of, you know, half dozen little coons turned in. And they're cute as buttons, of course, when they're little.
And they purr.
And they, you know, they'll climb all over you. You know, they get those little soft hands, and they eat anything. So these guys had a big cage, I mean really big, and they put these critters in. And they would, once they were above the milk stage, they would feed them leftovers from the chow hall. Mm. And the kids could look at them, and, you know, they'd grow them. But as soon as they got really big enough to be on their own, I would go up and pick them up, and I'd take them to a remote area where they wouldn't be around people, because it is a problem when they get to know people. So it wasn't great, but it was best we had. And let them go. Well, in this one story, I get up there to do this, and these coons are looking fat and sassy. But I discovered I'd forgotten my animal cage, the dog cage, you know, metal thing. And I said, you know, here I am. And it was a hot day or getting to be hot. And I really wanted to take them up to our wildlife management area up towards Albany. So I said to the guys, I said, you got a box? And he said, oh, yeah. So they came up with this big cardboard box, and we piled the little coons in, and they were all happy to jump in there for a little while, and closed it up, taped it up a little bit, and I put it in the back seat. And that time I had a Plymouth Cruiser. I didn't have a truck. And so I'm going down the road, and I've got the window open and the radio on, and everything's good, and I hear them back there squalling and scratching around. And then suddenly I noticed that it was quiet.
Always a bad sign.
Bad sign. Just like in the Westerns. It was too quiet. And I cranked down the rearview mirror, and I look in here. They're making an escape. Somehow they got the top of that darn box open. And they're starting to crawl around the back seat. So I figure, well, that's not so bad. You know, they're used to people. You know, I'm not too worried about this. And so I'm driving down, and they're starting to scurry all around. And pretty quick, they're on the back seat or the front seat. And they're in my lap. And a couple of them are trying to get out the window. So I couldn't have that. You know, I'm going down the road, and I started to crank the window up, but now it's a little hot with that. But meanwhile, I'm on a back road. I'm on the East Hill Eden Road, and one of these critters kind of climbs up on my shoulder, and then another one climbs up on my head. And, you know, they're cute little critters, but, you know, it's a little bouncy up on my head, so they get these little claws that they were sort of sticking into my skull. Fortunately, I had more hair in those days than I got now. But anyway, this one's kind of there, and meanwhile, a beater pickup truck comes by, and usually I know a lot of those guys. You know, they're either clients of mine or they're good friends of mine, one of the two, but they all wave. They all have a big smile and a wave for the game warden. Anyway, so this guy's starting to give me the big smile and the big wave, and he notices my live coonskin hat on my head. And the poor guy kind of froze up, and the last I saw him, he was bouncing down the ditch trying to recover to get back on the road. But I thought, that's kind of funny. So anyway, I'm going down the road, and meanwhile, apparently the Boy Scouts had decided to give these guys a big farewell breakfast. So they'd eaten a big meal, I think. I think you sense what's happening. So I'm going down the road, and all of a sudden, I feel something sort of gooey wet down my back of my neck. And I reach up with my hand, and sure enough, this darn guy on the top of my head had let drive. And then the smell hit me. Oh, and I don't know if you've been around coon crap, but it's nasty. And so the instant, I'm starting to gag from this. So, of course, I kind of ripped this critter off the top of my head, and which had its own ramifications. But anyway, I had to open the window up. I had to get some air. Meanwhile, the guys that are wanted to make a break for it, they're trying to make a break for it out the window, and I was at that point okay, you know. I'm on a dirt road, and I'm looking for a pull off with water. And sure enough, a couple of them got on the hood of the car, and I come sliding in. They went sliding off, and I opened the door and said, "Close enough for government work." Out the door they went, and down to the brook I went. But
that's fabulous.
That was the kind of stuff that we would get involved with fairly great. Often, actually.
Eric News, thank you so much for joining me this morning on Open Mic. We're going to have you back, and we'll talk some more about those wild tales. And we'll hear, I hope, from more of our listeners as well. You have been listening to Open Mic here on WDEV. It's our weekly chat show, and we're looking forward to another guest next week. We'll be back with Brett Stanciu, who's a writer in Woodbury, whose first novel is just coming out. We also expect to be welcoming Joe Citro. You may know him as the chronicler of Weird Vermont, but we've invited him in a different capacity for next week, and it should be a really interesting program about writing process, making fiction. Should be really, really an interesting time, and we hope you will join us for that. It is about a minute away from the top of the hour, and I need to remind you that you are listening to WDEV, broadcasting out of Warren, Vermont at 96.1 FM. Also, Barrie, Vermont, 96.5 FM, or from our Waterbury flagship station, the Nifty 550, AM 550 WDEV in Waterbury. You can also catch us worldwide on the internet, streaming live at WDEVradio.com. And you can also check out the podcast. You can hear this story again. You can download the podcast, Eric, and see how smart and funny you are.
All right. I'll put it on my blog.
There you go. You should do that. That would be great. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.